Now here, the second case, Denton County Electric Cooperative versus Nicole Hackett and others similarly situated. Megan, would you formally call the case and announce the attorneys, please?
May it please the court, Mr. Mark Bader to argue for appellate and Mr. Stan Burke to argue for the appellate.
Good morning. May it please the court. It was an abuse of discretion for the trial court to certify a class action in this case, which amounted to essentially a political dispute among members of the Denton County Electrical Cooperative, which we call COSERV. The trial court's order should be reversed for at least three reasons that I hope to discuss this morning. The first is that there are conflicts in the class, irresolvable conflicts in the class, that preclude certification. It was the movement's burden to show a cohesiveness among the members of the class, and they failed to do so. Second, the trial court failed to follow the Texas Supreme Court's mandate, one that has been repeatedly followed by this court, that there be a rigorous analysis of class certification. And then finally, Ms. Hackett, the proposed class representative, was inadequate and should have been rejected because of her lack of standing and her failure to supervise class counsel. I'd like to talk first about conflicts in the class. This is not a case about, quote, fair elections or, quote, democratic elections. That's just a thin veneer painted on this case by appellee's counsel to make it sound as if there's cohesion, because after all, it would seem that everyone would be in favor of fair elections. But the Texas Supreme Court says you have to peel back the onion, you have to drill down, and you have to understand how a case will actually be tried. And if the trial court had done that in this case, it would have understood that this case isn't about fair elections. It's about COSERV's Policy 310. Policy 310, which was enacted back in 1985, it's never been challenged or complained about since, except by Mr. Glover and his cronies, provides that information which is of a confidential corporate nature will not be provided to the membership, such as the names and addresses or telephone numbers of members, past and or current. And that was COSERV's Exhibit 88. It would have been Defendant's Exhibit 88 below. Policy 310 is intended to protect the private information of its members. And this case actually started when members called COSERV complaining that they were receiving phone calls, robocalls, from a candidate for the COSERV board, a confederate of Mr. Glover by the name of Janice Brady. When they complained to COSERV and COSERV investigated, it determined that Mr. Glover was the source of the confidential member information that had been provided to Ms. Brady, because the members who complained had unlisted telephone numbers, and the only way that Ms. Brady was able to get them was from Mr. Glover in breach of Policy 310.
Doesn't that policy discriminate in favor of the incumbents because they will have that information and someone else running for office won't?
No, Your Honor, it really doesn't. The board had a policy and an agreement that they would not use the member list in connection with the election, so it would be an even playing field. And we cite in our brief to the specific testimony of the court below where that did come out. So what you have here now is a political dispute. You have some members of the cooperative who say, I want my confidential information kept confidential. I don't want my unlisted number disseminated. And you have Mr. Glover and his cronies, on the other hand, saying, we should have access to that confidential information so we can use it for elections, because Mr. Glover had this scheme to try to take over the COSERV board. This is very similar to a case we cite in our brief, the PICO case, where a school district up in New York decided to ban certain books from the high school library, books like Soul on Ice and Slaughterhouse-Five. A group of parents disagreed with that decision. They thought the book should be in the library, and they attempted to bring a class action against the school district, claiming that they needed a class action to get an order that the school board return the books. The court there decided that a class action was inappropriate because you have this fundamental dispute between between members of the putative class. You have a fundamental disagreement between the members of the class. Some people want the books in the library. Some people want the books out of the library. Just like here, some people think that the confidential information should be kept confidential. The move-ins thought that confidential information should be disseminated widely. As a result, any relief through a class action was inappropriate and because of lack of cohesion. With regard to the rigorous analysis that's required by the Texas Supreme Court, and indeed this court, the trial court failed in the following three ways. First, superiority. The court did not adequately take into account the expense of a class action in this case. And the record is fairly clear, I believe. The discovery, the multiple hearings, a week-long evidentiary hearing on class certification, two follow-up hearings. A class action just wasn't a superior method of adjudication. Either an individual declaratory judgment action would have been superior, or perhaps a derivative action. Now, the response that Ms. Hackett makes is, well, that wouldn't be fair because members who want to challenge this policy wouldn't have the resources to contest COSERV's policies. And that's wrong for at least two reasons. First, it's wrong to say that all of the members of COSERV are individuals. In fact, many members of COSERV are corporations, municipalities, and school districts. 30% of the electricity COSERV sells is to corporations, municipalities, and school districts. And so obviously we're talking about some of the biggest companies in North Texas. They certainly would have the resources to contest COSERV's policy if they desired to. There's no evidence that any member of the cooperative did have this problem.
Why would those entities protest their phone number being given out?
They wouldn't.
Yes. They would not be in the group of people that would have an interest in pursuing this litigation.
Which brings me to the second reason why the argument fails, which is if an individual brings a declaratory judgment action and are successful, they're entitled to recover their attorney's fees. Right. So the rule has even the playing field in that regard. And the point about the large members of COSERV goes back to Ms. Hackett's adequacy, and I'll deal with that in a few minutes. Second, in terms of the rigorous analysis that's required, the court did have a trial plan. It's 10 or 11 pages. It's fairly long, but it's fairly superficial and very conclusory. It does not address how the legal issues that we raised in our special exceptions would be handled at trial. It doesn't address how a jury would go about resolving these political issues during the trial. It doesn't address the conflicts among the class or the conflicts between the class and class counsel. And there's no indication of what the jury charge would look like in a case where you're arguing about policy 310, whether this confidential information should be disclosed. And then finally, in terms of rigorous analysis, I think the trial court neglected its rulings earlier in the case. The trial court found that it was likely that COSERV would prevail on its claim against Mr. Glover that he violated policy 310. The trial court entered a temporary restraining order. It entered a temporary injunction. It rejected an effort to set aside that temporary injunction, all finding that it was likely that COSERV would prevail that Mr. Glover had violated policy 310. Well, now, when it came to the class certification hearing, which is really the opposite side of the same coin, the enforcement of policy 310, the trial court certified a class challenging 310, the same policy that it had previously indicated was viable and supported a temporary injunction. So it doesn't follow logically, and I think that's further evidence that there was not a rigorous analysis of the claims here.
I noticed, just as sort of a point of curiosity, but coming from what you just said, that we have a visiting judge handling a class action case.
Yes, Your Honor.
Did the visiting judge handle it from the get-go or just at the class certification hearing?
From pretty close to the get-go, Your Honor. There was a problem that most of the judges up in Denton were members of the cooperative, and so they recused themselves. And so we had a visiting judge from outside the vicinity who was not a member of the cooperative. The last point I was hoping to cover was Ms. Hackett's inadequacy as a class representative. First, Ms. Hackett never denies, and we point out in our briefs, that she was recruited late in the case little over a month before the class hearing and the trial were scheduled, she was recruited to come in and take the place of Mr. Glover and Ms. Brady as a class representative. She never denies that in her papers. Second, Ms. Hackett really was never disenfranchised here. Ms. Hackett has been a member of the cooperative since 2005 or 2006. She appears to be a very nice person, active in the community somewhat, but she's never voted in a co-serve election. She's never attended a co-serve annual meeting. She's never requested any information from co-serve management. She's never posed a question. She wasn't disenfranchised. It's hard to see how she even has standing to make a claim in this case, because she wasn't disenfranchised. She never voted. Ms. Hackett failed to monitor class counsel as she's obligated to do as the class representative. She admits she didn't read the pleadings before they were filed on her behalf. She admits that she didn't read any of the depositions or any of the trial court's orders, and there were lots of orders in this case below. She admits she didn't talk to the expert that was retained on behalf of the class. She admits she doesn't know how much time all her lawyers spent on this case, and there were 15 lawyers on the pleadings below. She couldn't tell us what her agreement was with those lawyers. She couldn't tell us what the facts of the case were other than what the lawyers had told her. She was completely inadequate. She completely failed to monitor the case. She didn't have independent knowledge of the facts other than she was a member of CoServe, she received electricity, and she paid her bills, usually late. That was her only personal knowledge. She didn't know anything else other than she was recruited in July to become a class representative.
Well, hearing what you're saying, but isn't the key factor as to whether or not she is affected by the dissemination or lack of dissemination of her personal information? And if she is, she's no different from any of the other class members out there that you could pick. And yes, the class member is supposed to monitor and know what's going on, but I mean, it seems to me the touchstone is she affected, like every other member of the class, by the outcome of the class action suit? Sounds like to me that she's just a typical member of the class. How is she not?
Well, if Ms. Hackett...
I'm going on typicality and commonality, and you're going on something else. Maybe.
Well, if Ms. Hackett believes that the policy is wrong, if she believes policy 310 is wrong,
okay,
her remedy is to vote for candidates for the board who agree with her, or even run for the board herself. It's fairly easy to run for the board of CoServe. You just need 25 signatures on a petition, and you can run for the board yourself. So if she believes that the policies of CoServe are wrong, her remedy is to vote for people who agree with her and change the policies.
We're going down two different paths. You're going down the path of what her remedy is. I thought we were talking about why she wasn't a representative of the class.
Well, she's not representative because the class is claiming that they were somehow disenfranchised, that they weren't able to vote for people that they wanted to vote for, or they had no way of knowing who the candidates were, or the candidates couldn't contact them because CoServe was not providing confidential information to those candidates. Ms. Hackett doesn't fall into that category because she didn't even vote. She didn't care.
I got you.
So, Your Honor, in conclusion, if Ms. Hackett believe she was wronged, she had remedies, she could vote in an election. She chose not to do that. She's not an adequate class representative. The class is not cohesive as required by Rule 42, and the trial court did not conduct a rigorous analysis of the law and the facts in reaching its determination. Therefore, we ask that the trial court's order be reversed.
What's the fallout of declaring her not an adequate class representative? I know what the fallout of the other position that you have is.
The move-ins have to meet every element of Rule 42, Your Honor, and if they don't meet every element, and in this case they don't have an adequate class representative, the proper remedy is for class certification to be denied.
And then start over a new representative?
If they decide they want to do that, I think a better course is an individual declaratory judgment action.
Well, I think that's different. Okay.
Thank you,
Your Honor. Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Burke?
Good Good morning. Sam Burke. I'm here for Nicole Hackett. There's a lot of issues they've raised with our class certification order, and I'm going to try to hit what I think are the high points and address some of the comments that Mr. Bear made. First of all, with regard to cohesion, which I think he's masquerading as common concern, the court is left with a clear choice here with regard to the parties' arguments on cohesion. Is the court going to apply LaPrey, the Texas Supreme Court directive on cohesion, or is the court going to apply the PICO standard set forth in a New York District Court opinion from 1979? The court should apply the Texas Supreme Court's directive on finding cohesion, which the court in LaPrey said is the same as determining predominance in a 42B3 class. And when you're looking to determine predominance, you look to see if there are common questions of law and fact. You look to see if there are individual issues which are going to make the class trial too complex. And you look to see whether or not the class action is superior. I think you can see from the manner in which Mr. Bear has framed his argument that there's not a dispute about whether or not there are common issues of law and fact. The issue is whether or not Policy 310 and some of the derivative policies of that Policy 310 affect the members in a way that is not legal. Do the members have common law rights to access the books and records of the cooperative? Do the members have the right to get lists of other member names so that they can contact them in an election if they decide to run? It's simply not enough to say that you can run for the board if you don't have a way to contact the other members of the cooperative and say, here are the issues. It's not enough to say you can run for the board of directors if you don't have the means to acquire the information about the cooperative to underlie your campaign. If you can't find out the basics about the cooperative, which the members of COSERV cannot, it is simply not enough to say you can run for the board. That's not democratic control. And I think what they say democratic control is would make an eighth grade government teacher blush. I think anybody who has had an eighth grade government class would know that if you don't have access to information and you don't have the ability to bring together an assembly of the interested members in a group, you don't have democratic control. And democratic control is a fundamental promise of this entity. There are common legal and factual issues, and Mrs. Hackett is typical. The third thing that you have to demonstrate.
How would it be functioning for many years without the?
How would it be functioning?
How had it been functioning for many years?
Not very well.
Without this?
Not very well. They found themselves in bankruptcy in 2002. They've come out of bankruptcy. They've probably been saved merely by growth in the county. Historically, they functioned pretty well because if you look at what a cooperative was designed to do, provide power in rural areas, there was a small group of people. They knew each other. It was easy to govern, you know, that small group. There probably wasn't as strong a need to know who all the members are. Now, if you look at the record before the trial court, you've got patchwork quilt of different areas. You can't just look at a map and determine where COSERV's area of operation is. You can't say I can call everybody in Flower Mound because their service areas are patchwork quilt within that particular area and other areas. So you don't have an effective way to communicate with the 142,000 members that you probably did when COSERV was founded because it was a much smaller group of people and the members knew each other. So I think the importance of the common law right to access to books and records and member list has grown as the cooperative has grown in number. And I think it's a matter of dispute, not so much for determination at this point, whether or not they are functioning very well. You know, they're functioning.
Well, I meant functioning in the sense of non-democratically, as you were articulating.
Well, they're functioning not very well. I think that their management is essentially controlling a puppet board. But I'm not sure I'm answering your question.
Okay, go ahead.
With regard to superiority, the court specifically found that this action was superior because of the mechanisms for enforcing the judgment in the Declaratory Judgment Act. COSERV has not questioned that finding. If this action is certified, the individual members, if they are not provided with access to books and records, if they are not provided with access to member names and phone numbers, will be able to have the access to a brief, expedient show cause hearing and get the information they need. This is especially important in a case such as this where the election cycle for COSERV is very short. They do not announce who the board of director candidates are until about a month before the election, sometimes 2 months. If you want to have a lawsuit and try to enforce your remedies through collateral estoppel, I'd submit to you, in my experience as a trial lawyer, 60 days is not going to get you there. A show cause hearing is a superior method of enforcing the remedy in this case. That's what the trial court found, and there's evidence to support that finding. The other argument, which Mr. Baer didn't address in his argument against the declaratory judgment action, is that a single member action would be superior. What they're really trying to get you to do is apply a new standard of Texas jurisprudence called needs testing. Needs testing is if you can accomplish the same relief from a single member action and it applies to the whole group, class action is not superior. There are only two circumstances when needs testing has been conducted by any court that we have found. One, in ADA actions where you're actually going to change the physical nature of a structure. In other words, it needs to be 4 feet wide in order to accommodate a person with disabilities. If they change the physical structure, it's changed. That is a wholly different circumstance than applying policies in the future, which is what we're trying to affect. The only other circumstance when needs testing has been applied that we have found is when you have a governmental official or government that's a party to the lawsuit, that's a defendant. The courts have indulged a presumption that because those people swear to uphold the law, that a judgment for one person will be enforced the same way for all people. That's distinguishable from this case for a couple of reasons. One, COSERV isn't sworn to uphold the law. And two, the court specifically found, based on the testimony of their management and board of directors, that they weren't likely to respond to a single member action. They had specifically disregarded the advice of their accountants and lawyers with regard to the policies at issue in this case. They're just not as likely to respond to a single member declaratory judgment action as a governmental entity is. And the court, there's evidence to support the trial court's finding in that regard. With regard to the rigorous analysis, you know, Mr. Baer alluded to the lengthy proceedings running up to the class certification hearing, When you're talking about enforcing the right that affects one vote, and you're talking about investing the resources that were necessary in this case, you're talking about 20 depositions, over 200,000 pages of documents, multiple hearings, a week-long class certification hearing. An individual is just not going to be motivated to invest those kinds of resources when you're talking about just affecting their individual right. It is a wholly different circumstance when you're talking about changing the landscape of governance for an entire cooperative for 142,000 members. This is exactly the kind of action that the rule of class certification, Rule 42B2, and its corollary in the federal rules was designed for. Where you have nominal or no recoveries, the Supreme Court has specifically said, that is exactly what class actions are designed for, to make something that doesn't mean a lot to an individual person, but can have a huge effect on a community of people possible to litigate. Make those rights real. If you don't have the motivation or the resources to enforce a right, it has no meaning. If I don't believe that these rights under that Policy 310 violates will have any meaning if this court does not allow this action to proceed as a class action.
Tell me exactly what it is you're asking for in this class action.
We're asking, 25 words or less. We're asking for the court to determine whether or not the promise of democratic control has been violated.
There's not going to be a judgment that says the promise of democratic government has been violated. What are you asking for exactly? Are you asking that 310 is void?
Yes.
Okay, that's what you're asking for.
Yes, and we're asking that the members be allowed access to the books and records pursuant to the Texas Nonprofit Corporation
Act. Because 310 is no longer in place.
Policy 310 doesn't affect that exactly. It affects it somewhat, but what I'm saying is broader in scope.
Why couldn't this be done with a declaratory judgment?
Because you don't have the same enforcement mechanism. Because you're talking
about...
310
is void. It's void. And you have certain rights, as you just articulated, under the Act. Why can't anyone come forward? 310 is out the window. Anyone, declaratory judgment, plaintiff or not, and 310 is out the window. I have rights under the Act. Give me the information. What's the difference?
I think that COSERV would say the circumstances that you're addressing here are unique or different from the circumstances that were addressed
right.
in the prior
310 is gone, and I have rights under the Act, period. There are no other circumstances to consider.
Well, I just disagree. I think the record made clear that they're not likely to respond that way. I think that, you know, in this case, they got a letter from the National Cooperative Corporations, which is, well, I'm not saying it right, but it's a lobbying group for the entire national cooperative organizations that said, your policy with regard to access to member contact information is bad. You need to change it. You know, they've cited in their reply brief minutes from their board of directors meetings, which they don't let their members see, which say that you can use this information for corporate cooperative purposes. And they argue to you today that board of director elections don't fall within that directive. This is an organization that just doesn't follow through if it doesn't think it's in the interest of its entrenched management and entrenched directors. You can look at their reply brief and see how they evade. The trial court looked at their past practices and saw how they evade. It's just not as straightforward.
How they did what? What word are you using?
Evade.
Oh,
sorry.
Evade. Oh, you're using obeyed. Okay.
No.
Got it.
Sorry, Judge. So I don't think it's just as straightforward as what is I would like it to be, as you say it. With regard to misunderstanding the law, there's only one circumstance when a misunderstanding of the law overcomes class certification, and that's when it's going to create individual issues that need to be tried, or it demonstrates that the trial court missed individual issues. That's not the argument they're making here. In fact, they say that the issues here are so common that the action should be derivative. And with regard to their briefing on the derivative claims, the cases that they cite to you talk about the special injury rule. And specifically, the case Wixon versus Wyndham, which they say in their briefing we didn't reply to, I believe is a misapplication of the special injury rule based on a misquote from a Delaware case that announced the special injury rule. And specifically, I think the later iterations of the special injury rule have dropped the word indirect. And there's an excellent law review on this article on this subject. And I would like to make an oral motion for leave to file a supplemental briefing with the court so as to point that article out to you. It's a direct versus derivative in the law of limited liability companies reported at 58 Baylor Law Review 63, 87-110, winter 2006. If you read that article, I don't think you're going to have any question that this is a direct, not a derivative action.
Oh, sure.
Ten days?
Five.
Thank you. With regard to Ms. Hackett's adequacy, just to sum up, I think Justice McCoy has it right. She sits in the same place as every other member. With regard to their argument that she doesn't have standing, I think that would be a better argument if we were attacking past elections. The relief we seek here is not in the past. It's current and prospective, and she's in the same place as every other member with regard to future elections and her current rights. Do you have any questions?
I'd like for you to address your cross appeal.
Yes, ma'am. With regard to our points on counsel, I think that we've been unfairly restricted, and the traditional role of class counsel has been unfairly restricted by the trial court. With regard to, for instance, the article I've cited to you, I might want to consult with the author of that article about briefing in this case. And I think the order of the trial court would not permit me to do that unless I went back to him and got permission. I think the traditional role of class counsel has been to supervise and direct the litigation. And the mechanism for making sure that you're not going to run up the cost is on the back end. Any fees that we incur, the court has to approve. And they have to, in this case, be directly related to a benefit that we've gained for the class. And so I think the court, which the only reason I think they've cited to you, or that I can recall at the moment anyway, is that the court was looking to the cost factor in restricting the counsel. And I don't think that's an appropriate factor to look at when, and as in this case, you're going to be able to clean that up on the back end. And all of us in this case are taking the risk that if we don't prevail, and if our work wasn't necessary to secure a right, we're not going to be compensated. And I think we ought to be able to be more than just adequate. We ought to be able to seek out those people and surround ourselves with those attorneys who's going to make our representation excellent. My light went off. Would you like me to speak with regard to bifurcation?
Pardon me?
Do you have a question about bifurcation?
Yes.
Yes, ma'am. Transactionally, some of these claims are related. And so I think there's a distinction between severance and bifurcation, which I think they try to make us say those positions are inconsistent. I don't believe they are. Initially, and to some extent I still believe, that this action should have initially been combined with the first filed suit, which was removed to federal court and later brought back down. And so we sought an abatement of this suit and or a combination with that suit. With regard to, and I think this ties in, with regard to our motivations about Ms. Hackett, part of the reason we wanted to have someone new in the case, it was jurisdictional problems. You know, if you've got a dominant jurisdiction problem, which I think we did, bringing in a new party who wasn't a party to the original action, I think overcomes those problems. And that, anyway, that was a major motivating factor in trying to seek out a new class representative. And I think if you just look at COSERF's pleadings, they detail the history of Mr. Glover, you know, lawsuits against him, past judgments, his voting record. None of that has to do with the legality of whether or not policy 310 is effective, if it meets with the requirements of the Texas Nonprofit Act or the common law. And I think what they want to do, which is what they've done today, is say that we are a proxy for Mr. Glover. We are not. I don't care if Mr. Glover is in office. I don't care if Mr. Glover is a member of COSERV. I want the members of the community to be able to find out about the cooperative they own. I want them to have access to information so that they can contact each other and decide whether or not they want to vote for a particular candidate or they have a particular issue. And those questions have nothing to do with whether Mr. Glover is honest, dishonest, lied to them, had prior judgments, was adequate as a representative, or whether or not he lied about what information he gave to Ms. Brady. Those issues are just not connected. And they want to make this class trial, a diatribe about the misguided efforts of one of their former directors. And that's not what it's about. And I think the rights of the class will be prejudiced if it's made to look that Mr. Glover is driving this action or that the recovery sought is for Mr. Glover. It's simply not. And so I believe the trial court erred in bifurcating the action.
Is the standard of review that we apply, because my understanding of your challenge concerning lead counsel is just the interlineation that the trial court made, that's what you're complaining of?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And so do we review that under an abuse of discretion standard?
Yes, ma'am. I think there's some
particular... And is it the same for bifurcation?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Rebuttal?
May it please the court, I will talk very quickly because Mr. Burke got some extra time. First of all, on bifurcation, it's two sides of the same coin. On the one hand, we're saying we should be able to enforce policy 310. On the other hand, they're saying we shouldn't be able to enforce policy 310. As they admit in their own pleadings, those issues are intertwined. And yes, Mr. Glover is driving this action. Yes, Mr. Glover is related to this case. After all, his lawyer, Ms. Benolkin, was appointed to represent the class. She doesn't represent a member of COSERV or a member of the class, and yet she was appointed as class counsel. Mr. Glover's lawyer. Inherent conflicts, therefore. Next, on the arguments about the puppet and entrenched board, those are totally outside the record. In fact, the record shows that two members of COSERV's seven-person board defeated incumbents, and the board has functioned well. Unlike many of the cooperatives, of the electrical cooperatives in the Southwest, COSERV has actually paid back patronage capital to its members. Its members have benefited from the good management of the board. Next, on the issue of how difficult it would be to contact 140,000 members of COSERV. Well, that wouldn't be necessary. The record below showed that candidates for the board typically campaigned around their houses. They'd walk the neighborhoods around their houses, and they campaigned face-to-face. Roughly 2,000 people would vote in the typical election.
But what good would that do if the people around their house weren't members of COSERV?
Well, everyone in that area would be a member of COSERV. COSERV provides all the electricity in a given neighborhood or area. And so if you go
but
to
you
your
neighborhood. You have no idea if it's one block over or 1 mile over, right?
Well, you can ask COSERV for a map to show the coverage area. But typically, if you're in a subdivision, everyone in that subdivision is going to be serviced by COSERV.
And how many members?
There are 140,000, but the board members are elected by district. So they're dealing with
so
a much smaller geographic area.
20,000 per board member, and you're going to walk?
Well, Your Honor, only roughly 2,000 people vote in these elections.
But you don't know which 2,000 it is. So let's see. 2,000 divided by 7 is 290 or something. So there's 290 people that voted out of 20,000 block. So how do you know who to go vote for?
Well,
who to go talk to?
All the members can vote, so you just go like any political campaign, Your Honor. You go door to door and you introduce yourself to your neighbors and you ask for their vote. The problem we have here, Your Honor, is they're seeking a remedy that is inconsistent with the desires of the class or the class of COSERV members. Other than Mr. Glover and his cronies, there's no one who said, we don't like policy 310. People don't want their confidential information being disclosed.
I thought the calls that were received, I read in the brief, amounted to two or three.
There were three complaints. That's
three
correct, Your Honor.
Three complaints.
That's correct.
Out of 140,000 members.
But, Your Honor, there's no evidence below that any person had a complaint about policy 310. Not one. Other than Mr. Glover, because he was trying to manipulate the campaign. If you read Exhibit 44 below, that was his campaign manifesto. He was trying to throw out all the other members of the board so he could take control of the cooperative. No one has complained. Not one person was presented below in that week-long hearing who had a complaint about Policy 310 other than Mr. Glover and his cohorts.
No one has complained that they didn't get called.
No one has complained.
I mean, what prompted the complaint? I got called. So nobody responded by complaining, I didn't get called, I want to get called.
Well, I see your point, but when it comes to the governance of COSERV, there haven't been complaints, is my point. Judge, a point on the allegation or the suggestion that COSERV wouldn't follow an order in an individual action. We stipulated below that we would be bound by an order in an individual action. And then final, the last two points. One, on the number of attorneys. They wanted 15 attorneys, but they never discuss in their briefing or here Rule 42G2, which says if there are multiple lawyers who would be adequate representatives for the class, the trial court shall choose the applicant or applicants that it thinks are best able to represent the class. It could a trial court faced with multiple lawyers seeking to represent the class could choose one. And that would be an appropriate thing to do. In this case, the trial court chose two out of the 15. Rule 42G2 specifically allows for that. And then finally, just a quick note, it's in our briefs, I think. The Nonprofit Corporation Act doesn't apply here in our view. It's the Electrical Cooperative Corporation Act that applies to our governance. And that act does not require us to disclose confidential information, member lists, the way that the Nonprofit Act does.
So you just gutted my argument when I said a declaratory judgment would work because this one person can throw out 310 and then they can come in under the Act, but the Act doesn't work.
And that's why we say it's a political remedy, Judge. It's not a legal remedy, it's a political remedy. If you don't like policy 310, knock it out. Change the policy.
If we could only get the numbers of the people who voted, we could do that. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your good arguments, and it's a very interesting case. Your case is submitted, and an opinion will issue. And did you want to file a written response or a supplemental?
Yes, plus
two-page, furnish us with the citation.
And Your Honor, we'd appreciate the opportunity to respond if it's necessary.
All right. It's granted.
Thank you.
Thank you. You're dismissed, and we'll ask court to be adjourned.